afternoon, all. Welcome to this latest episode of GDPR Radio. Hopefully you all know the format by now, but if you're new, then welcome. We're very pleased to have you. Very informal sessions. We just have a bit of a chat, really, don't we, Phil? What's been in the news, what we've been up to this week, kick around some ideas, share some knowledge. I've not even introduced you this week. That's how informal it's getting. So for those of you who are new, my name is Ollie Rear. I'm your host for these sessions. I'm joined this week by my usual partner in crime on this. We've not got Dave this week, but we have got you, Phil Brining. Afternoon.
Hello, hello. Yes, Dave's on holiday in sunny northeastern Scotland, I think, isn't he?
He is indeed, yeah. So he'll be back at some point, I'm sure. We can always call on Jasmine, who is having microphone difficulties this week, apparently, if we need an extra opinion. No, I don't either. So these sessions, as I say, very informal. They are as much your sessions, the guys on today, as they are ours. So please do get involved. Comments, questions, queries, concerns, anything at all. Pop them in the chat and I keep an eye on that and I'll pick them out. Or otherwise, feel free to unmute and dive in when prompted. We always like to get some participation going. That's what works best. So as I say, very informal, we'll have a little bit of a chat about what has been in the news. Before we do that, one last point of admin, actually. I do believe that we were meant to do a prize draw this week for those who attended our training and awareness session. Obviously, Miles isn't here, so that's going to have to wait a week, unfortunately, to apologize about that. But he'll be back next week and we'll get that underway. So without further ado, Michael's already beaten me to the punch. I think there's only one place to start this week, which is this government consultation paper, Phil, which we've both been desperately trying to get a handle on for the past couple of hours so that we can talk about it. Hot off the press, have you got any initial thoughts, reactions to that in particular?
Well, I'm interested to get the views of people who are on the session and who have managed to you know, see it, read it or everything, because I think that would be an interesting discussion. But I've only got to page 48, paragraph 177, and I've really skimmed through it. But actually, I have to say, I rather like it, if I'm being honest. And a lot of the criticism, if you like, doesn't appear to be necessarily of the law per se, but of the ICO's interpretation of the law. That's how I've read it. For instance, the accountability framework, you know, the accountability principle doesn't go anywhere near as wide as the accountability framework takes it. And in fact, we got a letter on behalf of one of our clients this week who'd failed to respond to a subject action request in a timely fashion. And the ICO pointed them to the accountability framework. You know, but the accountability principle is about complying with the other six principles, not about, you know, the other obligations of a controller, which I know we've talked about accountability numerous times on these sessions. But, you know, those kind of things, reforming the accountability framework, removing the need for a data protection officer, removing the need for Article 30 records, some of those things, I think, are probably good. And I started reading it thinking, well, you know, there's some outliers like research. There's a lot of information about research and AI, but actually when you get into the bits about the that affect the majority of data controllers, so far I've read it and thought I could see why they've come to that conclusion. And actually, you know, I think some of that is going to be helpful to people trying to manage data protection compliance regimes. What's your thought? But as I say, I'm only part way through it and I'm not ready in any great detail, so I'm interested in what everybody else has got to say.
Yes, I mean, I was just going to say your screen share has gone a bit wonky because you're showing the session on it.
Yeah, I'm just going to get the comments up, otherwise I won't see them. Conversation.
Yeah, my initial feel is that, to be honest, I'm a bit conflicted about it because I think, well, consultation obviously is an excellent idea. I'm very pleased that they're putting this out for people to respond to. I think it's very thorough. I think there are points which are really fantastic. I think there's some really good ideas in it. One that really stood out to me, because I think it's just not appropriate anymore, is reforms to the PECA,
which well, obviously not got that statute bit from, yet, but yeah, not got that yeah, to that bit yet.
Statute from 2003. Yes, it's been updated since, but I've often said that it's just not fit for purpose in the modern world for a variety of reasons. So they want to overhaul that. There are a couple of things I really like in there. They want to change things about cookies. I know we've had a lot of chatter recently about the dreaded cookie laws. But to be honest, this takes a relatively reasonable approach, I think, to it. It also takes a relatively reasonable approach to the issue of electronic direct marketing, I think, although I did notice that they want to relax the soft opt-in for political parties because that is seemingly promoting political engagement. I can't help but feel like if you were a charity, you'd feel a little bit hard done by on that front because they've not extended it to them. So there are lots of things. I mean, also the other thing under Pekka, just to finish on that point, is that they are proposing to extend the fine regime under Pekka to bring it into alignment with the broader GDPR and Data Protection Act. So again, I think that's a good thing, making it more enforceable. I don't have an issue with that in the slightest. Mm. But there are points that I'm not so sure about.
Yeah, it's some interesting comments already. So Toby's saying, what about adequacy? But in the opening statements of the of this paper, you probably have seen it. They say that they don't think these proposals are going to create an issue in adequacy. And what they argue that places like Israel don't have an equivalent regime to the GDPR. They have their own regime, but that's deemed to be adequate. So I think there's some fair points, to be honest, that are made. I was interested in the discussions about consent and, you know, how, and I have to say, Ollie, we have not so much recently, but initially we found, I don't know when the government did their stakeholder review, but initially when we were working with the GDPR in the early days, there was massive confusion about lawful basis for processing and, you know, the application of Data Protection Act Schedule 1 stuff. And everyone did rely on consent. And do you remember, we had loads of cases, you know, and we were saying, you don't need consent for this. You can rely on legitimate interest. So I think that some of what they say is or was true, I don't know if it still is true, but publishing a list of legitimate interests, you know, is going to be a good thing, I think.
Yes, I completely agree with you on that front.
To Mark's point, I'll keep coming in a sec. To Mark's point on cookie law, I agree with you that absolutely agree with you, and I have done, and I've expressed that view on here, that the Pekka is okay, providing you haven't got this overzealous interpretation of it that we have in the UK, in my opinion. And yes, you know, some of it is just bonkers. You know, in my view, you should be able to seek consent through email for unsolicited direct marketing emails. It's not a massive burden on people, but of course that's unlawful. I'd be interested to see what happens to those who've been fined, like Honda and Flybe, who were fined in the past for kind of unlawful behavior that then becomes lawful, or potentially becomes lawful.
Yeah, what's interesting on that front, I think, and particularly in the context of whether it affects our adequacy, is that I noticed in particular under the Pekka point that they sort of say, well, actually, we're looking to adopt a more European interpretation of Pekka laws, or of the Privacy Directive, I suppose. But, you know, in France, they deem that analytics tracking, the use of cookies for analytics tracking doesn't require consent because it comes within the strictly necessary exemption. And they're saying, well, we think that's proportionate. And, you know, I tend to agree with that.
I tend to agree with that as well. Yeah, I tend to agree with that.
So some of it is some of it is proportionate, I think. Some of it still demonstrates, I'd argue, a bit of a lack of understanding of how this all works in practice. There's one bit in particular which I found baffling in terms of how they've done their research. There's a quote here I've got which says that, so this is under the bit you mentioned before, Phil, confusion around lawful bases. And there was a quote that I picked out specifically where it says that from their engagement with stakeholders, the government has found that 53% of those who thought that the UK GDPR is unclear stated that they spent a disproportionate amount of time working out the requirements. Further, 42% identified the lawful grounds to allow processing was the difficult part. So just so I'm clear on this, you've asked people who don't understand the law what the difficult parts are. Isn't that really the right approach to take? You're really going to sort of take that metric?
Well, we don't know who they have asked, but again, I've kind of owned up the paper thinking, right, I'm going to enjoy ripping holes in this. And actually, I haven't. You know, I've actually read it and thought, actually, yeah, there's some good points made here. But again, there seems to be quite a big bias towards public sector, only insofar as what I've read so far. And maybe, you know, they've sought consultation from public sector, maybe public interest task and legislative interest. Well, there was confusion about public authorities relying on legislative interest or not being able to. And again, I think that's some of the ICOs built into it. I tell you what was really funny there. To me, you know, they say the UK GDPR has got a ton of recitals. It's got no recitals.
It's got no recitals.
It's got none whatsoever. So what? That was a bit weird reading that. I thought, nah, you've got the wrong end of the stick here, mate.
This is what's odd about it, in that there are a number of very good recommendations that seem to have come from people who do regularly work with the law. And, you know, that's a great thing. But at times it also makes assertions, as you say, just there, that clearly demonstrate that you don't fully understand what it is you're dealing with. One of the ones I thought was a really good recommendation, although I'm happy to be challenged on this, is that they... on the public bodies point, Phil, they say that they're going to, well, they suggest that where you're a private sector body and you're working with a public authority and they require data for certain processing purposes under their performance of their tasks or in a public interest, where that's the case, then you as a private sector body may be able to rely on that same public interest or performance of a task of a public authority for your lawful basis, which I don't think is unreasonable either.
No, I don't either.
I think that's probably pretty proportionate. But as Mark's saying, it's a pretty big gamble politically, if anything else, I'd have thought. You know, we've had a lot of tension around this. And I think, not Michel Barnier, but someone at the European Commission recently was saying, you know, you've got to be careful because we've granted you this adequacy and we can revoke it if we want to. To then sort of lay down 150 pages of ways in which you're going to divert from your current regime seems like a bit of a...
They talk about outcomes, you know, and they talk about the GDPR being prescriptive. Well, it isn't, in my opinion. I mean, what the ICO says is sometimes prescriptive, but... So I think I take this as largely a criticism of the ICO and an attempt to build some sense and proportionality into some of the measures. So looking at data protection officers, we know full well, right? Okay, so that piece to me doesn't work. Like, we've got a load of schools we're talking to who pay, you know, £300 a year sometimes for a data protection officer. Well, what kind of service are you getting for £300 a year? If an average self-employed consultant is charging £600 a day, that's half a day a year. Well, what's the point? You know, you're just ticking a box, literally just ticking a box. So that mechanism doesn't work. I mean, I don't know what kind of input you would get for that, but mathematically, it doesn't work. So that piece, we know that people have horrendous problems. I was at a client on Wednesday, first time I've been on the side of a client for about 2 years. And, you know, they said, I need to pick your brains on information asset registers. I said, what do you want an information asset register for? Oh, we've got to have one. I said, no, you don't have to have one. You need to have records of personal activities. What are they? So we went through this. And I went, crikey, you know, they said, this is going to take us ages to put together. This is a tiny little company with really simple processing. But teasing it out into kind of, I said, you really need to go to the lowest common denominator. So HR processes is probably too broad. So break it down into five or six: recruitment, selection, training, you know, performance review, etc., background checks. But, you know, really the lowest common denominator is at what point do you start introducing different recipients or different data classes, and that's the level I think to go to. But, you know, they're complicated to put together. So taking away that requirement, I mean, they'll probably end up reverting back to what they had before, which was, you know, maybe an elaboration of the public register. So in the old days, and those who've been in this game for many years we'll know that in the old days you had to fill in a form and all the data classes were specified, C1, C2, C3, and the data types were classified D1, and the recipients were classified R1, R, you know, and you filled in the form, you ticked all the boxes, and it was a very detailed process to go through. But this do-it-yourself you know, record supporting activities is hellish complicated to put together, and therefore there's probably no consistency, and probably therefore what's the point in it? Anyway, yeah, off my soapbox. I'm going to get off my soapbox.
No, no. Well, no, this is the whole point, isn't it? Get back on that soapbox. But my initial gut feel about that is just sort of saying, well, you know, all right, fine. There are issues in implementation. There are issues in consistency. It's not currently working. But does that mean you just get rid of it? I don't know. I mean, part of me as well, when I'm reading this, I can't help but feel that, particularly on the points regarding DPOs, DPIAs, and ROPAs, which, for those that haven't had a chance yet, they're suggesting that we scrap all three in some form or another. I can't help but think that it's all a bit of a PR exercise, because really what they're suggesting is that we broadly keep the requirements, we just sort of reformat them slightly, well, and we get rid of the acronyms, seemingly. Well, maybe I'm
what,
being
what have they said on? I haven't read the breach bit yet. What have they said on breach notification?
Yes, yeah, so on breach notification, they've basically said that people are over-reporting to the ICO, which I suspect is the case in a certain number of organisations, but I can't imagine that the entire country is over-reporting.
Again, when did they do the stakeholder review? It probably was the case in June 2018, but, you know, is it the case now? Don't know.
Well, quite possibly, but I mean, from the number of times that I've seen breaches not reported when they should be, and the number of times that I've seen, you know, overzealous reporting, like, obviously small sample size, but I simply don't believe that over-reporting is that big of an issue. But what they're saying basically is that they want to change the threshold. So obviously currently the requirement is to report everything unless it is unlikely to pose a risk. But they want to move that to say that you only have to report a breach where there's going to be material damage, I think they said.
Right,
which
okay.
I'm not entirely sure about. A, you're going to have to quantify that pretty heavily, and B, I don't know. I mean, they also, in there, I'm pretty certain when I went through, they've misunderstood the reporting requirements themselves, because I don't think they fully understand what unlikely to pose a risk means, because they seem to think that it's if there's no risk at all, which I guess, you know, I'm not entirely sure that's necessarily the case. But maybe you're right. Maybe a lot of it is to do with a potentially overzealous interpretation of it all. And maybe that stems from the regulator. So maybe that's what it is. I know reforming the ICO is a big part of it. But I think there are some really good ideas to sort of round off my view on it. I think there's some really fantastic ideas. Some of it I don't agree with. And I think it still demonstrates the same sort of lack of understanding on some fronts that the Tiger report demonstrated, but I'm not necessarily completely opposed to it, I'd have said.
So far, yeah. I've not got to the bit where
from,
they're saying...
Yeah, from
somewhere
my
I've
real
read
skim
that,
read.
Yeah, somewhere they've said... I mean, the interesting is they organise to comply with the UK's current regime should still largely be compliant with our future regime, except for only a small number of new requirements. So I've not found those new requirements yet. I know they're proposing to put in new law for research and some other new legislation, some clarification, which is probably a good thing. But they're saying that they deliberately build on the key elements of the current general data protection regulation, such as principles and rights and mechanisms for supervision and enforcement. So I guess it's the obligations on controllers and processes that are the bits that are getting tweaked. But they did find something, I did highlight something, and forgive me for not being able to remember what the heck it was. And I thought, oh, that's really quite interesting. And some of it, Ollie, is, and there's a lot of this going on, is one of the examples used is COVID, isn't it, and data sharing within COVID. So it seems to me, again, they're jumping on or potentially jumping on this kind of heightened sense of, oh, yeah, we've got to be able to do this to avoid COVID again. But, you know, again, there's nothing wrong with reusing data sets. And, you know, the current law provides for extending the purposes of processing, particularly for research, providing you jump through certain hoops. But there's a few bits that I want to reread this.
While you look for the bit that you're trying to find, I think part of it, and again, maybe this is what I said previously, I think part of it is in a similar vein, potentially, to when we were talking about the so-called great NHS data grab. I think part of the issue here is how this is all coming across and how it's being communicated, which is kind of, I guess, what you're saying in terms of what we're going to jump on the COVID thing. We're going to jump on the fact that it's Brexit so we can do what we want, etc. I'm just not entirely sure that the tone is quite right to it. And maybe that's something that's irrelevant, but I think in context, it's probably quite important, especially when we've had so many rumblings between, as I say, the European Commission and the DCMS particularly. I think potentially let it all blow over and then you can start having your reforms. But right now, I'm not entirely sure is the right.
Yeah. Well, I hope they get a representative response to their request for consultation. We're going to submit we're going to submit a opinion, aren't we? An opinion on it and answer their questions. The bit I was going to highlight is on page two. It's on the introductory bit by Oliver Dowden, which says that the reforms outlined in this consultation will, you know, fourth bullet point, reinforce the responsibility of businesses to keep personal information safe while empowering them to grow and innovate. Now, so far, I've only read 50 pages, but I've not found anything that reinforces the responsibility of businesses. I've found things that kind of take away obligations, but nothing that puts any kind of other responsibility in its place. Have you found anything to do that?
I'm just trying to think, but no, I think you're right. They systematically sort of put out this message that, well, we want to empower businesses without reducing their responsibilities or the protections afforded to data. But you're right, there's nothing in there which really, well, there are a couple of points which raise standards on some occasions, but broadly speaking, it's all about lowering standards, really, across the board. There are very few instances where we say, oh, actually, this isn't sufficient, so we're going to move it up, we're going to crank it up a notch.
I don't know if has anybody else managed? I mean, I wasn't aware this had come out, Ollie. I was happily sort of beaving away on something else until you rang me and said, you better get your head around this because we're going to talk about it in an hour's time. I don't know if, has anybody else seen it and read it?
Yeah.
I mean, one of the key things is what the impact it's going to have on us as privacy practitioners. You know, what is it going to lead to? Is it going to lead to a much tougher job of working with the regime, you know, within our organizations? I'm thinking of particular clients that already the data protection team have got, you know, under pressure from the ops team and this marketing team, you know, to bend the rules or to ignore the rules. Is this going to be making things easier for us, or is it going to make things harder for us?
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, one of the big things is reducing burdens on businesses is one of the things they sort of really hammer home. I don't know if you got to the bit on SARS, but they want to change SARS, obviously.
No, could come back to that in a second. But, you know, at the moment, we've got a regulatory regime where, you know, it's quite explicit in the law. Admittedly, there is lots of kind of flexibility, but, you know, like data protection impact assessments, you know, you've got to do them in certain circumstances. Same with breach reporting, same with the records of personal activities. The grey area is, well, is this high-risk processing or is the likelihood of harm? You know, that's the arguments that we have, isn't it? Whereas if you take away the entire mechanism but then start saying we're going to reinforce responsibility of businesses to keep us information safe while empower them to grow and innovate, well, how are you going to do that? And what's that going to mean for us trying to do our job and guide our organizations down a straight path? What's Rick's making a good point on data flows again. So we'll touch on that, especially as you this week have done your first international transfer risk assessment, Ollie, which was an interesting exercise. But what did it say on SARS in this paper? I don't know if there's anything else other than this, but I think that's enough for a couple.
No, the only thing I wanted to cover was what you've just mentioned, was the fact that I didn't really have a play around. I was obliged under very stressful circumstances, a real tight deadline, to undertake one of the ICO's new transfer risk assessments. So I think they put out that template. It's a draft. It's out for consultation.
And it's also not mandatory to use. It says in their guidance, though, you can use whatever you want. This is just one tool.
It's not, but, you know, I had about 48 hours to complete one of these assessments, and I didn't really want to try and come up with the format in that time and also conduct the assessment. So I stuck to what they were giving me, quite frankly. And that was the only other thing I wanted to cover today. But just quickly to finish the point on this consultation for reform and the SARS point, just because it's an interesting one, is they want to start, basically they want to make it more difficult, or at least they want to reduce the scope for excessive SARS for very large burdensome SARS. And one of the things they want to do is they want to introduce a fees structure. They don't want to just go back to the £10.
£10.
Hello. What they want to do instead is introduce a fee structure similar to the Freedom of Information Act, and basically say that you're going to we'll calculate the cost on a sort of time and materials basis, and there'll be a max cap for that. So I think it's what currently is 600 for central government, 450 for other public authorities, or have I got that wrong? There's a cap, isn't there, I think? But
I've not read that bit.
No, in terms of in the Freedom of Information Act currently, isn't that one of the
There is a cap, Yeah.
And so basically they want to introduce something similar and say that depending on the scope of your business, of your processing, etc., we might introduce caps to say that, well, at a certain point you max out and you don't have to respond to SARS within that. I'm not entirely sure. I mean, part of me thinks that I think one of the benefits of SARS being so readily accessible now, and I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of, I might get cries from those who have to deal with them regularly, but one of the positive things to it is that it actually forces you to sit up and take notice and deal with these things. You know, I have businesses that have absolutely no controls in terms of their retention in place. Their information management systems are all over the gaff. And having these big SARS that can come in at any time, and all of a sudden you've got to mobilize and deal with it, you know, it puts pressure on you to get your house in order. And if you start introducing a cap to that, then what's the incentive to get your house in order, really? If you say, well, actually, because our systems are a mess, it's going to cost us this much to comply with it, and therefore we're not going to acknowledge it, or we'll only acknowledge it for, you know, however many hundred pages.
There's still presumably the complaints regime in. So we got a letter this week from one of our clients who had received a complaint letter from the ICO saying that this person submitted a subject action request 22nd of June, I believe, from the top of my head, and they chased it again on the 24th of July and said, you haven't responded to my site, not even acknowledged it. They then acknowledged that and said, all right, well, we didn't get the first email, which clearly they did because of the email trail and a form off their website. And then they finally provided a response on the 2nd of September. So, you know, pretty tardy approach to it, really. And now they've found that there's even more data that they've got to put in the scope of the SAR, because they use WhatsApp and other social platforms to communicate internally as a matter of policy, and they allow people to use their own devices. And according to the current guide, of course, all that falls within the scope of the SAR. I guess, you know, you put in what they're suggesting in the paper, people can still complain that it's not been dealt with properly, and there's still the fines regime and the information notices, etc., to force data controllers to comply.
Yeah, agreed. But as I say, I think there is somewhere a value, I think, in the burden which is so heavily chastised by this paper. I don't, obviously, you know, we don't want to create unnecessary burden, but particularly on the SARS point, you know, if you've got to deal with it, it's going to make you sit up and take notice.
Now, there is stuff in here about data sharing, isn't there?
Yes. But
I've not seen anything, maybe I should just search for the word, for processes. Anything on processes?
I didn't notice anything, I'll be honest. As I say, I only really skimmed it. And if anyone has seen anything, then please do.
I've seen one reference. You remember data intermediaries is one of the mechanisms. Again, it seems a sensible mechanism to put in place. And I've read about it in other places as well. But they're saying that, you know, there could be data intermediaries allowing the transfer of data between different organisations. And it says they could actually be processes. That's the only bits I've found about it.
Yeah. So it's... Well, I think that's kind of one of the key focuses, isn't it, is reducing these burdens and getting rid of some of the obligations. And obviously, most of the obligations are going to be on controllers, I suppose. So I guess that's where that comes from.
Do you want to pick up on the international transfers?
Yeah, I was about to say, should we have a chat about that? unless anyone's got anything else they want to talk about on this particular proposal. I mean, it's fast, and you know, we've got to be honest, we've both only flicked through it. I mean, it came out this morning. So we've had a chance to bore over the 150 pages or so.
Christina's point is a good point. That she's saying she agrees with you on SARS in general. One of the rights to somebody to access their data. It sounds like this is now going to be limited. But again, how many times have we seen subject access requests being misused, really? No real purpose. I have to admit, I've done that myself. I've raised SARS with organisations that have irritated me with the sole intention of just, you know, giving them a bit of grief. Well, that's not what it's there for, is it?
No, it's not. It's not. But then again, you know, I can't help but feel like in some circumstances, if I'm putting myself in the shoes of the consumer, you're going to take anything, aren't you, really? If you've been hard done by someone, as you say, you've been irritated by a company, what other mechanisms really do you have to get back at them? And I mean, the other thing being that I did notice this in the paper. They talk about the fact that SARs are supposed to be purpose blind, but we've seen through UK case law precedent that, you know, that's not the view taken in the courts, that actually they do consider the purpose of these requests. What was it, Lees v. Lloyds or Lee v. Lloyds just recently?
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, was that, you know, they heavily considered whether what the purpose was behind the request. And they said in that case, well, actually, your purpose was to try and obtain a specific document. It wasn't to access your data or understand how they're processing it. So we think they were justified in turning them down in that instance. So again, you know, I'm not entirely sure they have got the full picture or necessarily the right angle on it. But I tell you what, let's put a pin in that. As I say, if anyone wants to come back to it, then please do. But should we talk about this transfer risk assessment tool that I had pleasure of tackling? So for those who maybe don't know at this point, basically, obviously, in the wake of the Schrems 2 case and everything around that, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but obviously one of the main things was that if you're going to use standard contractual clauses, you should carry out a risk assessment on the country which you are sending your data to the paper.
Share my screen again. So, yeah, no, carry on, Ollie. I'm just showing there's three documents being published. Fine. These are the three, and there's a good overview of it all on an Alexology article, which you know, gives you links to all those documents and also some, you know, good insight onto the key takeaways. But anyway, carry on, Ollie, because these are the documents.
No, 100%. And all I was saying was that obviously, if you want to use standard contractual clauses, you need to put in place supplementary measures. And in order to determine what those supplementary measures might be, you need to risk assess the country that you're sending to, and particularly their legal regime, to see if, in particular, their current practices will undermine contractual protections and whether there's a significant risk of third-party access to the data that you're sending and whether you can effectively counteract that with supplementary measures. That's pretty much the headline, isn't it, Phil, really?
Yeah, it is, But so a real interesting exercise, should we say?
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, there's plenty of ways of doing this. Obviously, in the wake of the Max Schrems case, a lot of focus was on the USA. So I'm sure we've all heard about FISA 702 at this point, which is one of the big ones that allows you to access, if you're a US public body, allows you to access information on foreign civilians for intelligence purposes, etc. So anyway, one of my clients wanted to use SurveyMonkey and MailChimp for a couple of bits they were doing. A contract which one of their clients was getting ready to sign was kind of hinging on this because the DPIA hadn't been finalized and they were refusing to go ahead until we'd done this, basically. So they said, could you expedite the process, which I rather foolishly agreed to. So I went ahead and did this, and my main takeaway from it, the entire experience of attempting to risk assess both the American legal system and the particular use of basically service providers in America, the likes of SurveyMonkey and MailChimp, I'm just not sure that it's all right. I'm not sure the angle's right on it. I'm not sure it's appropriate. I'm not sure it's the right approach. I mean, quite frankly, you know, for small to medium enterprises across the country, it's just not going to be proportionate to get them to spend the time, energy, resources to conduct one of these assessments into, you know, do third-party beneficiaries under contracts in America, is that something that which is respected? Businesses aren't going to bother with that, quite frankly, I wouldn't have thought. And if they do, then they might struggle because it's extremely complex. When we were first talking about it, Phil, a while back, when the Schrems ruling came out, I think one of the things that we were saying was that effectively, you know, one entity, whether it's a law firm or whether it's a regulator or whoever, could take the lead on this in theory and undertake one of these assessments and say, right, we've had a comprehensive look at the American legal system and American legal culture, etc. Here are where your risks are, okay? And now go off and assess your use of a product or service against that. But the ICO doesn't seem to agree with that. They seem to think that it's the responsibility of every controller to undertake these assessments. And as the links that you've shared there show, it's, you know, the responsibility is put back on controllers. And I just don't think it's appropriate, quite frankly. As Andrea says there, it's, you know, a risk-based approach has to be the most proportionate way of doing it. And when one of the ones I was doing was, as I said, MailChimp, which was, we'd load up a list of full names and email addresses to MailChimp and then send out a newsletter, right? Perfectly innocuous. I shouldn't have to do a 70-page assessment on FISA 702 to be able to do that. It just cannot be proportionate. I'm happy to be challenged on that. Maybe it is reasonable, but when I was doing it, it just didn't seem right. I don't know what your thoughts on it, Phil, but that's me on my soapbox, and I'll get down
from
it now.
I read through what you'd prepared, and I thought that in many areas it kind of missed the mark, really. I think that what it's asking us to do is way too complicated, in my opinion, and therefore, you know, we're not going to get the right result because it's just too, I think it's too complicated.
Yeah.
But they do say you can use any tool you want. You know, you don't have to use their tool. But you know, it was a complicated. It's obviously a complicated thing to put together, and it was made for complicated reading as well.
Yes, and I apologise for asking you to proofread that for me.
I enjoyed it, honest.
But yeah, poor Matthew, I think, is reading them currently for me and trying to put together our response for a consultation on that, the poor chap. So we'll have to see what he says. But I don't think it's right. I don't necessarily have the answers currently, because clearly you can't just say that, well, it's broadly fine to send your data to America, off you go. There has to be more to it than that. There has to be more accountability, and you have to do better risk assessing than that. But I'm not sure this is the right approach at all on it. As you say, I think it's too complicated. I think it's too burdensome. But
the other thing, Ollie, is I know that the people on this session are all, you know, seasoned privacy practitioners, as we are, and you know, we struggled to do an effective assessment without going through the motions. My overall feeling was, we're just going through the motions here. We don't know, you know, any of the answers to questions that are being posed by the ICO's tool. Well, you know, when it relates to you know, the country transfer data. And we know a lot about the American regime because it's been all trawled through the Schrems, hasn't it? But, you know, if you wanted to transfer data to, you know, somewhere else that we don't know much about, then how are you going to find it out?
Yeah, Steph's, I think it's Steph has linked the Max Schrems' charity's advice on it. Which I hadn't checked, but I mean, it's incredibly difficult because, I mean, in practice, a lot of the service providers you're going to want to use in America specifically are going to be caught by FISA in some way or another. But, you know, when I was looking into it, you can check Apple's transparency report, for instance, where they publish their numbers, and they're astronomical. They're huge. They get loads of requests all the time for this sort of thing, because they're Apple, because they'll have that information.
Yeah.
But I compared that to SurveyMonkey, and SurveyMonkey they also publish their numbers, and they get 13 requests a year, more or less.
Slack's the same as well. I've seen the Slack numbers before, and they're in the double digits.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And because, I mean, there's got to be some degree of proportion to it, I think. And currently, there isn't, whether that's just from the ICO, which is entirely feasible, and I accept that. And I'm happy to take responsibility for the fact that, as you say, the ICO don't necessarily say that you have to use their template, but
It's
I
a good
thought in the
starting point
interest
without
of,
creating your own under pressure.
yeah,
Yeah, it's a good
exactly.
starting point. And also, at some point, it needs testing in the field, doesn't it? Which is effectively what
Yes.
you've done. So the community should be grateful to you, Ollie.
I'm not sure about that, but I'm happy to anonymize as far as possible the results of the work I carried out and share that potentially. But it's not, in all honesty, I'm not sure how interesting it is because it's just me trying to piece together whether there is a likely risk of my client's data being accessed under FISA effectively, and whether I think that third-party beneficiary rights under contract are protected in America, which I don't know how much value there is in that. But all that to say that, it's incredibly difficult, and I don't necessarily know what the answer is, but that was my experience with it.
Yeah. Now, I don't know if you've also seen, moving kind of on to other topics, that there's a proposal to change the Network and Information Systems Directive or regulations. And I'm not sure regulations. I'm not sure whether anybody on this is critical infrastructure or critical services, national services. So they're probably of no consequence to anybody. But I noticed that in the news this week. And also new guidance issued by the ICO, which again is one of my partially read documents for public sector organisations. And I was really keen to have a look through that because part of it is in relation to public sector organisations and their communications and the PECA. So again, if there's people in on from public sector organisations, that there is some new guidance out, which is probably worth getting on top of, or at least having a look through it and seeing, whether it's of any interest. There's quite a lot happened this week, actually. And Deliveroo in Italy got fined. It got 2.5 million euro fine for profiling Deliveroo riders. Such, they scored them all, availability and speed and all that kind of stuff, and all that saying was very untransparent. So there's been other things happening as well, but you're kind of quite right to highlight this big thing at the DCMS.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, Mark makes a very good point here, which I agree with, where he's sort of saying that we've got to remember that all of this really transpired because of a problem in US law. So in theory, if you wanted to do this and you wanted to send your data to somewhere in
India.
South America, for instance, or India, you maybe wouldn't be confronted with the same problems. And sort of saying that, at a certain point, do you just move to a different provider in a different location? And is it a case that you spend your money on a particular provider or on your impact assessment? But
Well, wasn't that
I
one of the
can't.
conclusions that I suggested to you
Yeah,
on this one you did? Because
it
it was on
was.
SurveyMonkey. It was, well,
Yeah.
you just trying to shortcut the whole process by choosing a different survey platform.
I know, but surely that can't be right. I mean, is that really what we're going to have to come to in terms of, these assessments are so disproportionate that we're not going to go with our preferred choice of provider and
Why
instead
is
we're
it
going to.
a preferred choice of provider?
Well, it's not for me to say. I'm just the
Fair enough.
DPO,
Fair enough.
but
Cop out. Just because
wait,
it's
but it isn't
easy.
though.
It's easy. It's well known.
Well,
It's cheap or
for them
free, you know.
it's. Yeah, but those not perfectly valid reasons to go with a
Why
supplier.
is it free? We know why it's free, because data is the product, not the service. Maybe
Listen,
not the
it's not for
service.
me to say, but it's not for me to
There's a
say,
good
but
cartoon we've got somewhere we
it's what
put
it
in our
is.
training slides, which is if the service is free, you're the product.
Yes, yeah.
Anyway, so
Anyway.
what else have you been up to this week then, or what else have you noticed?
What else have I noticed? Well, that was obviously the big one. I also did quite a large piece of work, which you may have been reading this morning, which relates to effectively if you receive information in error, So someone sends you something and then, you know, folds it up and says, oh, hang on a second, you weren't meant to have that. Are you entitled to hold on to that information, particularly if you think it might be legally valuable if you've got a case upcoming? Which is a very interesting question. And there's a lot tied into it. Obviously, one of the things which I considered at length was the applicability of Section 170 of the Data Protection Act, which potentially makes it an offence to do this sort of thing. But also more broadly, whether this type of information is admissible in court, which admittedly is slightly outside of our remit, because then you're talking sort of civil procedure rules and that sort of thing. But a very interesting query nonetheless. I don't know if it's an issue that anyone on the call has been confronted with previously, either from the perspective of having received something which you shouldn't have and thinking, hang on a second, this is quite interesting, I might hold on to it, or vice versa. Maybe you've sent something out, you've asked for it to be deleted, but either the person has refused or you can't get confirmation of that. I've certainly seen both sides of it. You know, particularly, I'm afraid to say, in social housing, where a lot of emails go amiss. It does happen. And I've seen, as I say, both sides of that. It's an interesting question. Say, if anyone wants to contribute to it. I mean, broadly, my feel, I don't know what your feel is on it, Phil, and potentially if you're only halfway through. Oh, have you not? Okay, fine. Fine. Well, I'll tell you what, let's have your gut feeling on it then. In terms of what you think the sort of reasonable approach is there, and whether you think it's acceptable to retain information in that scenario.
Well, I think I said to you that, you know, anything that's been put in the public domain, you know, whether this is the public domain or not, is potentially fair game, isn't it? I think your point back to me was, well, does this constitute public domain? You know, but information that's manifestly been made public, well, it manifestly has been shared with you. You know, otherwise it wouldn't be there, would it? So that was one of my thoughts. Yeah, supporting the argument that yes, it probably is something that you could put an argument together, whether it stands up or not. You could put an argument together that it's been lawfully obtained because it's been provided to you.
Yeah, well, I went through that process. I'm not entirely sure I agree with you on the manifestly unfounded, manifestly made public point. For a couple of reasons, the first of which being that that's very specific to Article 9 and Article 10, isn't it, under the Data Protection Act. So that's one of the potential conditions under which you can process criminal offence or conviction data, and it's also an Article 9 basis. And I'm not entirely sure that sharing something with potentially a provider, but you know, maybe subsequently realised that was a mistake. I'm not entirely convinced that constitutes making something manifestly public. I'm happy to be.
Well, you could argue anything after the event, like, oh, sorry, we didn't mean to give that to you, therefore we'd like you to delete it or pretend you didn't get it. I mean, you've got to take personal responsibility, haven't you, for what you email and put in sufficient technical controls to stop mistakes happening. So, you know, you could apply that argument to anything. We'd like you to delete that now, please, because actually it was a mistake to share it with you.
Yeah, I take your point on that. But as I say, I'm not convinced that is making something public, sharing it with a supplier. That's not how I've interpreted that provision of the law previously. But hey, maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
No, you're probably not, Ollie. I'm just chucking in an alternative view.
No, you do right. Rick makes a good point where he says, in reference to our mentioned Section 170 of the Data Protection Act, is there actually any evidence of the ICO enforcing on that front? And you're absolutely right. I do raise it as sort of a minor point in this piece I've put together, which is that you should probably be aware of Section 170 and also director's liability, which is what, Section 198 or something. But really, has it ever been used? I don't think so. I'm not entirely sure, but I'm not aware if it has. So, an interesting one. Is there anything that
it has been used. Yeah, not in the 18 Act, but in previously. Yeah, but that's more about people stealing data. So it's not in your context. But remember those two guys from Nationwide Car Hire both got prosecuted under Section whatever it was of the old Data Protection Act, but effectively 170. One got a fine of a couple of £1,000 for stealing data and selling it. And the other one got 6 months in prison for the same offence.
Under the Computer Misuse Act, though.
Yeah. It was interesting. Again, that was interesting. The ICO changing tack, because previously they said as a matter of policy, then they wouldn't use that act, and then they change their position on it.
Yeah, that is interesting. All I was going to say was, is there anything else that you've come across this week and you wanted to raise? I mean, we've somehow again managed to fill near on an hour pretty easily. So if there's anything you wanted to cover before we...
Not particularly, Ollie. Next week I'm doing my, or a diarise to do, which I've had to move twice. I've got to do my annual requalification for the PCI-DSS. So that's like a 3-day, it's dull as ditch water. You've got to literally run through this online PowerPoint, which is narrated by some nauseating voice, and you know, it's the same stuff, and you have to go through it slide by slide by slide by slide. You can't move on till the narration finishes. It's horrendous, if I'm being honest. But at the end of it, you've got to do a test as well, so I've slated that for next week. So hopefully by the end of next week I'll be able to shout about my requalification or not, as the case may be. So I'm doing that next week. This week I went off to see a customer on site, which is, as I said, the first time I've done that for many months, which was good. So it's nice to get out face to face. I didn't relish the 5:30 start on the 8:00 PM return home. That's one of the disadvantages of going out on site. But it was good to get out there and see customers, you know, face to face, and, you know, spend some quality time with them. So I enjoyed that. What have you been doing this week? What have you got next week?
Oh, what haven't I got on next week? Rick making another good point, which is that if they get rid of the DPO requirements, we may all soon be working towards QSA qualifications.
That's a really good point, because in what I have read, there is something about, not that exact point, but something similar, like effectively certification programs. There's something about certification, or it doesn't call them certification programs, but it refers to Canada, where there's certain, is it data protection compliance programs, which I read to be effectively standards. So again, what the paper says is they're looking to adopt that. Again, I think that would be a great idea.
Yeah, Canada's an interesting one, because they only have a partial adequacy decision, don't they, under their, it's called, their Personal Data Act, effectively.
Yeah.
But it only applies to the private sector, I think, unless I'm mistaken.
No, you're right.
Steph makes a really good point, actually, here, where it's saying, but back to the DTMS ICO stuff, he says, moving forward, any UK company who wishes to service companies in the EU will need to prepare something that acts or responds to questions relating to EU data transfer impact assessment documents, competitive advantage ? It's a really good point. I mean, we're going to have to prepare for EU companies having to undertake their impact assessments on the UK, I suppose, their transfer risk assessments on the UK. And we're going to have to be ready for all that, in theory, particularly if we lose adequacy, I'd have thought, which at the minute doesn't seem that unlikely, considering they seem to be pretty keen on poking the bear at the DCMS, don't they?
They do.
Very good point. So I think you asked me what I was doing next week, sorry, and I completely ignored the question in typical politician fashion. I am doing some CCTV work next week, actually.
Week. When will we be able to see you then? Are you being broadcast? Oh, CCTV broadcast.
I'm doing some CCTV work next week for a client who has a slight lack of control over their operations. So effectively, we're reviewing everything they've got in place, auditing their systems, etc., which is important piece of work, but not the most fun, let's be honest.
Well, yeah, I think it's quite good fun doing that. Mark's saying he's had to go early, which is a shame, but thank you very much for joining us, Mark. And same to you, Rick. So what we said we would do is we've asked one of our guys, Matthew, who's excellent at kind of analysing and cutting through this type of information, to do a review of the DCMS paper and to prepare our official response to it. The group here thinks it might be useful for us to share that or to consolidate some of this down, then, you know, we can have a look at doing that. Depressing. I'm not sure it's depressing. I mean, I don't know, what's your overall feel for it, Ollie? Is it depressing what's being proposed, or is it a breath of fresh air, or it's certainly a lot more turbulence you know, a lot more uncertainty before we reach certainty.
Yes, I think that's probably the key point, is that I think, if not depressing, I think the Tiger report was definitely quite depressing, because that seemed to demonstrate a far greater lack of understanding from our government on these issues. I think this is slightly less of an affront here, but I do think that it is quite tiring, potentially, that we're constantly getting this turbulence, as you say. At a certain point, you sort of go, right, get together, sort it out, decide what you want to do, and then let us know. Because at this point, you know, it's getting quite difficult and quite tedious, actually, keeping up with a lot of it, I find.
Yes, Steph, we're not hoping to get certainty, Steph. We'll be out of business if there was certainty. I think there's going to be change, you know, coming. And if I'm being honest, you know, we're working as consultants, and not everybody is fully compliant, and some of it is a real battle to get compliant. So, you know, maybe this is going to be a good thing for us as privacy practitioners. If the rules get watered down slightly or tweaked a little bit, that, you know, that might actually make our jobs easier. Don't know. Might devalue us. Don't know.
Well, there's just no way to tell, is there? But it's we'll have to see. I mean, but as I say, I think from my perspective, certainly slightly weary. Particularly, I think there's constantly at the minute.
You're
I
weary.
Think,
you've only been in the game about 4 or 5 years, haven't you?
Yeah, less than that. Shush. but no. I mean, particularly the political undertones to a lot of it, I think, is quite wearisome. I'd argue the backwards and forwards between the DCMS and Brussels we had over the last few weeks, I think, is quite grating, potentially.
A couple of last points, Ollie. No idea of timescale on this, is there? I mean, I'm thinking, when's the next election due? You know, what's going to happen if, you know, another government comes in and has a different approach? What happens? You know, there's lots of yeah, things that could happen. So let's not kind of assume this is all going to happen. What's the time frame on this? Is it say in the paper?
I'm not entirely sure, to be honest with you. I didn't notice one in there. It's what I mentioned this previously to you, which is that one of the big things to me about it, and I don't want to get on my soapbox again because we're actually run out of time now, but one of the things is I'm not sure the timing's right on this. So I think you do make a very good point as to potentially when are they looking to get this in place. Doesn't seem to include a time frame, but... No, you're absolutely right. Change of government, you never know. Could all go out the window. Who knows?
Yeah, interesting times. Interesting times. Right, you're right, Ollie. It's 13:31. You've rabbited on for over an hour.
Yes, absolutely. I'm not going to take full responsibility. I think you can share the blame on that one.
I blame Jasmine for it. You're rabbiting on. She set us off on the attack before we even started.
Exactly. Anyway, let's bring this to a close. So thanks all for joining as ever. Good session. Always good to kick these things around. Always good to crowdsource some opinions on these new developments. We will be back next week. Unfortunately, Miles isn't with us right now. So
we're talking about the PCI DSS, and we've got one of really good consultants. They're all really good, of course. But Jamie in particular on the PCI DSS has been working in with the standard for 15 years. He's got many years at Visa when the standard was introduced. He helped form, you know, design it from a card brand point of view, and he's really, really good, very knowledgeable. So we're having a session next week on the PCI DSS, and again, there's lots of questions that come up. Does it apply to me? You know, I'm a small school, you know, handling a few credit card payments. Do I have to comply with it? So we're going to cover a lot of ground in it, I think. So Jamie Rose will be on with me and probably somebody else, hopefully somebody else, to talk through the payment card industry data security standard.
Yes, excellent. Very much looking forward to that one. It's one which I am not nearly as knowledgeable on. So I'm very excited to hear you and Jamie on that one. So yes, we'll be back next week, same time, same place. Miles will be sending out the links if he hasn't already done so. We'll also run that competition next week, because I think Miles should be back. So again, apologies about that, but we're back next week with it. And until then, hopefully this weather holds up, because it's lovely here now. And you all have a wonderful weekend.
Yes, thank you, Ollie, for hosting, and thank you very much, everyone, for your participating and for your contributions. Have a cracking weekend. Catch up with you next week.
Absolutely. Take care, everyone.